These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
In an article for Insurgent Notes, Matthew Quest asked, what type of historian was C.L.R. James? C.L.R. James, native of Trinidad, was a historian with a speculative philosophy of history. He brought these methods to his narrative of Haiti and Black Jacobins, and later in his Nkrumah the Ghana Revolution in 1977. James was influenced by historians of the French Revolution, while his approach was shaped by Trotsky's A History of the Russian Revolution, Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, and the Edwardian Radicals, G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, both literary men who wrote polemic histories sympathetic to the social motion of commoners. James's notes on dialectics explored the intersection of Hegel and Lenin as applied to the history of the international labor movement. But his original view of dialectics was just as much informed by how he understood the craft of writing history. For James, dialectic did not mean simply history moved by contradiction. Rather, history was a series of ruptures with hierarchy and domination. At its best, he did not read history in a manner that placed the development of the nation-state as the primary unit of analysis. For James, the working classes, be their wages high or low, and the unemployed possessed a hidden depth, a latent understanding, and a creative genius. Ordinary people, not professional leaders of official society, were the chief actors of history. Humans faced institutionalized oppression, but also partial hindrances they placed in their own path as part of pursuing freedom. History did not move simply by materialist laws, but by romantic elemental drives where the dispossessed push from behind those who aspired to lead or rule. Highlighting another important contribution of C.L.R. James to Black radicalism, Matthew Quest unpacks his political economic analysis. Quest writes that C.L.R. James is recalled as a pan-African and independent socialist, a colleague and critic of anti-colonial politicians and activists such as Trinidad's George Padmore, Eric Williams, Stokely Carmichael, Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah, Tanzania's Julius Nyerere, and Guyana's Walter Rodney. James's political economy was fundamentally different than his associates. While there are apparent moments of unity, especially around how the empire of capital underdeveloped Africa and the Caribbean through slavery and colonialism, or how federation might help enhance peripheral nations' sovereignty, James was distinctive. He saw the state, party politics, democracy, and the working class in contrast to Pan-African and Marxist-Leninist orthodoxy. Quest goes on to argue that the Black radical tradition, after experimenting with European radicalism and socialism, never developed its own independent political economy. As a left libertarian and autonomous Marxist, James founded his own doctrine with comrades in the Johnson Forest tendency of American Trotskyism. His mature politics benefited from the journey but was finally a rupture with the Trotskyist movement. This produced small American Marxist collectives, i.e. the Correspondence Group, 1951-1961, and the Facing Reality Group, 1962-1970. These politics could be summed up as advocating direct democracy, worker self-management, the autonomy of Blacks, the colonized, and women, and rebellion against totalitarian bureaucracy. Before the age of Third World National Liberation Struggles, most of James's original economics were expressed in The Invading Socialist Society, 1947, and State Capitalism and World Revolution, 1950. Facing Reality in 1958 also illustrated some aspects of his political economy. These small booklets anticipated problems with general staples of third world political economy before such theories consolidated themselves. Beginning with a critique of the Soviet Union, James started to develop a political economy for the whole world. He was concerned with the militant hostility to labor's self-emancipation. For James, there is a connection between state planning and repression of the toilers, and he in no way subscribes to classical liberal market economics. We must remember that James's mature political economy was worked out not just in response to Russia, but Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal welfare state and its repression of self-directed action during the CIO labor movement. While James recognized differences between imperial centers and peripheral colonized territories, he did not formulate his economics consistent with anti-colonial nationalist values that assumed that there were competing blocks of capital in the world, richer or poorer nations, some being progressive and others reactionary. Instead, James always, with the social motion of independent labor in mind, was analyzing political economy from the approach of how workers and farmers could arrive at their own authority. Today, we will explore C.L.R. James's thought, paying specific attention to his articulation of notions of direct democracy, workers' self-emancipation, and meditations on autonomy with Matthew Quest. This conversation will be presented as a three-part series where we specifically explore C.L.R. James as a frame of reference in the context of current labor struggles, the opportunities and potential limitations of demands within labor movements where we think through the limitations of labor demands being divorced from direct critique of imperialism and colonialism, and how does C.L.R. James's conceptualization of autonomy and direct democracy have an important part to play in conceptualizing labor movements today. To understand the depth and the range of impact of C.L.R. James's work, I would describe him as your rapper's favorite rapper. Your favorite theorist, revolutionary, radical, Pan-Africans had to or at some point must come to terms with C.L.R. James's work. His influences are both undeniable and misunderstood. Matthew Quest has taught African, African-American, and Caribbean history at universities including Georgia State University in Atlanta and the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. He is a known scholar of the legacies of C.L.R. James. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule and to have a conversation with us about C.L.R. James. Thank you for taking the time to join us, Matthew.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Thank you for your kindness.
No worries at all. And thank you for sharing perspectives, your thoughts, and, you know, kind of thinking with and through and attempting to think beyond C.L.R. James. This is a giant in the context of intellectual production for the African world. Pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism, imperialism, direct democracy, autonomy, workers' emancipation, you know, those type of, you know, those concepts become very important when we're thinking about C.L.R. James. And also, you know, how people tend to rest C.L.R. James in particular eras as well. But thank you for, you know, providing that work and sharing those ideas and encouraging us to think again with, through, and beyond C.L.R. James. We want to kind of be sure that I publicly address that as well. What we wanted to do tonight is kind of move through C.L.R. James's praxis, his thought and his practice, and his implication for current movement work. Some of the key points, obviously, that I want to kind of interject into our conversation is really exploring C.L.R. James in the context of current labor struggles, the current opportunities and potential limits of demands within the labor movement. I'm thinking specifically of limitations and demands as being divorced from direct critique of imperialism and colonialisms in the political economy, but also how does C.L.R. James's conceptualizations of autonomy and direct democracy have impact, are important
in the conceptualization of labor movements. You know, and with that being said, let's just start here. How do you approach the study of CLR, James? What are some of the important strands of thought that can be extracted in order to provide a framework to first understand workers' struggles, and then to help us understand the current global order, particularly as it's evolving into something else?
Well, one way to start is to remember that CLR James is a pillar of the Black radical tradition, but as a historian, he also invented the tradition. And while people are familiar with Cedric Robinson's book, Black Marxism, subtitled The Black Radical Tradition, Cedric Robinson was in school in the early 70s in Michigan with CLR lecturing on From Du Bois to Fanon and basically codifying the Black radical tradition in that period. But he has always been interested in individual talents of what he would call the archive of anti-colonial individual talent. And so there's an overlap there with labor movements because most anti-colonial thinkers have been socialists in some way, have been labor organizers in some way. Maybe they've worked with trade unions. That's not the only way to organize labor, but and so there's always an overlap between the Black radical tradition and various types of socialism. Now, CLR, many have said, is the ultra-left of the Black radical tradition, assuming that most Black Marxists in the tradition have attached themselves during the Cold War to a vision of a one-party state or welfare state. And the reason why CLR's vision of direct democracy and worker self-management is so important is because not only is he an advocate of class struggles, but he's also someone that believes the majority should govern. See, democracy means majority rule in the dictionary, but most people accept it is a veil for a republic or minority rule through periodic elections. And so if we're concerned with radical political thought, we also have to have our core foundation solid as to what, how we think about the state, how we think about political economy, how we think about party politics, how we think about democracy. And what is labor's role in that? Is labor's role just to go to work? We'd be surprised how many progressive people think, in fact, that's the nature of being a progressive, right? Is that we think that we're on the side of workers, but workers' basic job is to go to work and someone else will govern, hopefully benevolently from their point of view. So, CLR understands that democracy has two contradictory meanings, a tradition of revolutionary popular liberation, usually taking the form of popular councils and committees for direct self-government, right? Or, as I suggested earlier, democracy means minority rule through periodic elections. So when we're mobilizing people, as we talked the other day, when we're raising supposed consciousness or awareness, what do we want people to be aware of? What is their actual role going to be in rearranging or reconstructing society, assuming it's institutionally and systemically oppressive under capitalism and under the state? Of course, also under patriarchy, white supremacy, the turn toward ecological destruction, etc. But far more than we realize, it's impossible to get close to CLR's ideas because the conventional language of whatever people think is socialist and progressive politics actually openly collaborates with the bourgeoisie. I don't know if that would surprise you, but to C.L.R. James, it would not surprise him. Would you like me to give you an example of what I mean by that?
Yes, please do. Yeah, expand upon that, kind of unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's very common today to talk about critiquing neoliberalism, as I explained in the article on African labor in the world community. But to critique a neoliberalism, which is a silly word in and of itself, because most people are not taught the difference between classical liberalism and welfare state liberalism, which has changed over time how people think about economics. But the critique of neoliberalism is almost always pro-capitalist, and it impacts and undermines how most people think of a labor movement. The search for a Green New Deal is the search to collaborate with industrialists and to reform, not abolish, the banks and the financial institutions. The critique of neoliberalism is the critique of certain policies of capitalism, not capitalism itself. The critique of neoliberalism does not object to states and ruling classes. It actually thinks some ruling classes are progressive, and they would like to be a partner with the state. And anybody that's organizing labor with these ideas in their head are very, in the name of being progressive, are very dangerous people, because their conception of freedom, in the name of strategy, they openly propose to collaborate with half the bourgeoisie. And that mirrors itself in people's electoral politics. So CLR would have been aware of these problems because he was an implacable foe of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And while he was being an implacable foe of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, the idea of progressive as we know it today was invented. It was invented to justify the collaboration of orthodox communists with the left bloc of capital, not just in the United States, not just in the Soviet Union, but all over the world. And as I said in the African Labor and World Community article, the contradictions of New Deal economics and the contradictions of third world anti-colonial economics are almost virtually the same. And it's clear to me, and it would be clear to C.L.R. James, because his analysis of state capitalism, which he wrote with his comrades a few small books about, clarifies that. So the critique of neoliberalism is searching for state capitalism, which is, you know, the highest stage of the evolution of capitalism. Many people say still live by the highest stage of imperialism, as Lenin talked about it in the early 20th century. But the issue is now, if we're observing political economy, and it's not clear why we observe it for many people, but if we're observing it, we have to say, how are we going to oppose state capitalism? And those who are critics of neoliberalism, those who are looking for some new combination of BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, nations, those who say they're critical of American empire but identify with Russia, China, or Venezuela because of their supposed progressive political economy, they reveal to you their conception of politics and economics. And so they have no role for labor to play at all in their conception of struggle, except when labor rises up, these people with a certain type of elitism and a certain type of, they think they're being rational in their administrative conception. They say, well, when the people rise up and protest, that's good, because that might give us leverage for our party or our policies to have a greater piece of state power. whether through elections or seizing state power during an uprising. So to be able to talk about these things is consistent with the main currents of CLR's views. CLR's analysis of state capitalism made it very clear that under the empire of capital, while you have peripheral nations with their populist politicians talking about their fighting for national development, what they're really fighting for is the right to manage and subordinate their own labor. Many people talk about the problem of extractivism. This is a kind of consistent perspective with Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. But Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, no one can tell you what was underdeveloped. It's obvious to someone who can read, right, who doesn't just see the old cover with the white hands tearing Africa apart, like, oh, that's kind of cool, right? It's like, for people that can read, what was underdeveloped was Africa's capitalism. It's on that basis that Rodney critiqued pre-colonial governments, is not understanding trade, technology, the need to do research and development, to develop industry, because that's how you build states. And what is a nation state? It's a hierarchy of social classes, and it's a concentration of the monopoly of the means of coercion, the police, the military, the prisons, the intelligence agencies. So when people are state builders, they are building a regime for minority rule above society. And CLR James would have been able to point that out because he had a vision that to bring the new society closer, ordinary people have to take responsibility. This is what every cook can govern meant. That's an adage associated with his ideas. But everyday people need to take responsibility for economic planning, not the professionals and formally educated. Everyday people need to take responsibility for foreign affairs, for judicial affairs, for education and all cultural matters, for housing and healthcare. Now, as workers, the global working class produces everything already, and they distribute everything already. But the kind of higher strike action, a general strike, a wildcat strike, or the type of labor action that wants to take over a city, building on networking, taking over workplaces and city, the workers already produce and distribute everything. So the question is, on what terms will the workers control the social relations, not just of production, because some people play around with a little worker participation, right? But it's not just economic production. It's how are they going to govern society? So if we don't have political thought that's putting the tasks of self-government in ordinary people's hands, not, again, not the professionals, not the middle classes, not the aspiring rulers, but the ordinary toiler, the unemployed, the street force, the single mother. If we're not putting the tasks of government in their hands, in our conception, then we're not arranging a new society. At CLR's best, that's what he's talking about. Then the question becomes, with the idea of African labor and the world community, is many people like to make a big show of their anti-racism, their opposition to white supremacy, their opposition to empire. But it's obvious that most progressive activists maintain a eugenics disposition. What do I mean by that? I don't mean that they're for medical experiments or silly racial IQ tests. I mean that they believe that the working people are not fit to govern. And so they don't conceive of a society where they will be governing. They're not fighting for that type of society. And that's what the discourse of consciousness raising usually is about. It's about this perception that ordinary people are deaf, dumb, and blind, have been miseducated, but somehow a bunch of formerly educated, you know, overstated middle class or aspiring middle class people have figured out how the world works, but they are permanently going to have difficulty explaining it to the ordinary people in the name, because they say they're political teachers. They say they're political organizers, right? So CLR would say, if you constantly point to the backwardness of ordinary people, their prejudice and blind spots, it's your method, it's your philosophy that is failing. And then that raises the question, how does CLR see the future socialist society emerging in relation to questions of consciousness? Maybe you want to ask me about that, or you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so CLR James is very much concerned with after struggle, right? But he's also very clear about the methods and methodology towards that beyond struggle. So he's thinking about the idea of what does the state look like after it is taken over, controlled by the masses, the workers. These conceptualizations of consciousness raising, direct democracy, and worker self-management is the way within which he's attempting to do this, but he's doing this in a global context by centering, of course, there's a CLR James Pan-Africanism, right? That he's trying to kind of move through as well. How do we look at this in the context of this moment where you have rising global, fascism and those particularities that are happening in their particular areas, but they're having a global connection. Worker self-emancipation, direct democracy, and consciousness raising in this particular moment directly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, CLR, to many parts of his long life, lived through periods where fascism was on the rise. To some extent, I don't know how people view history and politics, but I've never known fascism in the world not to be a danger or a factor right around the corner. Because, as CLR talked about, the other side of establishing the future socialist society, assuming it's a self-directed one by ordinary people, is the reality of barbarism. And so, whether you're talking about the 1930s, you're talking about elements in the 1960s or 70s, whether in Britain, in the U.S., in Trinidad and Ghana, in China and Cuba, wherever you want to look, there has always been the threat of fascism. Now, fascism can be defined in many ways. And if there's a major danger today that's new, it's that people are not aware that fascism can take on a multiracial, multicultural character, right? People are still looking for a Klan or Nazi organization of the past. And even the newest forms of, if you wish, revanchist populism or people leaning toward a kind of, whether it's Make America Great Again or Make Hungary Great Again or Make Turkey Great Again or India, right? It's a nationalism that presents itself as popular, as trying to tap into the discontents of ordinary people, right? And playing on people's prejudices and blind spots, offering them empowerment under capitalism, when in fact, if one has a socialist perspective, one knows that every class in a nation cannot be powered, empowered equally under capitalism. But I don't know why the hell one would advocate a Green New Deal if they understood that. I don't know why people would cheer on China, the communists, the capitalism, if they understood that. So the threat of fascism is a combination of false populism attached to state planning that presents itself as in pursuit of a collective goal, but in reality is trying to preserve national capitalism. And it's a kind of rhetoric that in this historical period doesn't correspond to reality, because while people want to have a new Cold War for various ideological reasons, all the people supposedly clashing are already economically integrated. And the fact that anti-colonial thinkers evade that and don't make it plain shows you how despicable they can be. So, for example, it's obvious that Goldman Sachs has invested and other American-based corporate capitalists and banks have invested in Venezuela's national oil wells. That's a public secret. Anybody that can read the newspaper knows that. It's obvious that J.P. Morgan is advising China on how to organize its stock market, and China has owned, you know, the vast majority of the debt of the U.S. government. So what, they're trying to overthrow each other? The economy is totally integrated. You see? So you can't have a clash. You can have a clash of nationalisms for the working people if you can fool them into that, but there are no independent national bourgeois. And the claim to be independent is independent in relation to what? They're always making some kind of false collective claim as if the aspiring wealthy and the unemployed and barefoot have something in common. That's what the rhetoric of the so-called poorer nations is about. It's a veil for national state capitalism. And it's just the hearkening back to the era of Bandung, where it appeared that, you know, the national bourgeoisie, the populist national bourgeoisie of Indonesia, Egypt, Yugoslavia, Ghana, that somehow they represented the peasants in the world. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, you know? So while there is some differences in the world today, certain challenges, for example, for many, many years before 2017, there's been a direct action anti-fascist movement in the United States, actually for multiple generations. But the one that's called Antifa began as ARA in the 80s. Okay? Now, in relation to the uprisings against police brutality from 2014 to 2020, when you have communists with the Democrats and activists with the government saying the threat of Trump, we need to have an anti-fascist vote for Biden. And all over the world, people affiliated with this network of parties and thinking said this. Now they want to tell us that Biden is a white supremacist and imperialist in relation to Israel-Palestine. His disposition toward Israel-Palestine never changed. So is the goal of anti-capitalist thinkers to choose one capitalist state or one imperialist over the other in the name of anti-fascism? Well, during World War II, that's what ignorant people did. They discarded the class struggle. They discarded the independent power of the labor movement to collaborate with states and ruling classes above society. And they thought the new society was a type of bureaucratic regime that repressed the workers. That's certainly what Russia was. That's certainly what China was. That's certainly what the U.S. was. It continues to be those things. So the current challenges continue to draw on the philosophies and archives of the past with very little innovation. And the reason why CLR is a fountain of fresh thinking isn't because his thinking didn't exist before, right? It's because his thinking was not attached overwhelmingly to a state and ruling class. And so people said, well, maybe he was a writer, and maybe he was around, and you know, but if you don't have a state in the world, if you don't have a block of capital in the world, you're not even doing politics. So that gets to the question of what is politics? Is politics maneuvering for a hierarchy of outcomes? You know, like when you run for office, you promise the prisoners that you'll get them better food, and you promise the homeless you'll give them a shelter, and you promise the unemployed you'll give them a minimum wage job, and you promise the minimum wage, you give them a little more wages, and you promise the middle class you get to manage and boss the working class, and you promise the ruling class that they'll get rich off of your new schemes to pave the roads and build bridges. And that's socialism? That's barbarism. That's hierarchy and domination with a little populist coloring. Right? It doesn't even take seriously that the working class produces and distributes everything. So now, when we think about fighting imperialism, a major aspect of CLR's experience that made him who he was the Ethiopia Solidarity Movement in the 30s. He was part of the Pan-African Circle with George Padmore, Ross Makonnen of Guyana, Wallace Johnson was from Sierra Leone, but he was active in many places in West Africa, right? And there was Amy Ashwood Garvey, and he was part of this coalition, but that was the Black coalition. There were many groupings expressing solidarity with Ethiopia. And then, of course, Haile Selassie went into exile in Britain. And both African Americans, Caribbean people, African people have been propagating a similar intervention in Ethiopia that was happening in Spain at the same time. The Spanish Civil War is 1936 to 1939. The Italian invasion of Ethiopia and the occupation was 1935 to 41. So Haile Selassie, Emperor Haile Selassie, who the Rastas think is Jah, right? He went and gave a famous speech to the League of Nations. Hey, don't forget us. Remember, I'm a part of the League of Nations. You got to defend our sovereignty. So the British, you know, allowed him to stay in exile, and they eventually, with the U.S., put him back on his throne in 1941. So what happened? The Pan-African movement that only was concerned about Black power in any hierarchical state form said, well, if the British want to put him back, let them put him back. And CLR said, but we organized Black workers and nursing corps all over the world to go fight in Ethiopia to fight the Italians. But Haile Selassie and his diplomatic corps told them, no, please don't do that. After all, the British don't want you to do it. The Americans don't want you to do it. And so right then and there, from very early in his public life, we have the problem of coalition politics in relation to anti-imperialism. We have people opposed to imperialism who work with the imperialists all the time. Any experienced anti-imperialist activist, if they're going to actually educate people, they would tell you that. If they're educating, now if they maneuver in, they won't tell you. But if they're educators, they have to tell you that. Every book points to it. Pick a struggle. South Africa, Cuba. There's always a back. Aristide in Haiti. There's an open collaboration with the empire. And it gets to the problem of self-determination. Now, CLR, when he went to speak with Trotsky in the late 30s in Mexico about black nationalism and self-determination, people have noticed he's kind of tepid on the question of self-determination. Well, most Pan-Africanists and communists want state power so bad, no matter what they're telling the people about the insults of imperialism, they're constantly in dialogue with the imperialists. Because self-determination, even though some self-help psychobabble people think it means autonomy, it does not mean autonomy. It means the right to have a state and ruling class and be recognized, to have your state and ruling class recognized in the world system. And once you're working for that, you're going to repress all democratic sentiment in your movement. Pick a country, South Africa, Cuba, Russia. Pick a historical place. They all do it. And they're doing it today. The joke about Aristide being anti-imperialist, I don't know how much these people have to openly collaborate with American empire for people to see. You see what I'm saying? They're constantly collaborating.
No, this point becomes very, very important to tease out because, you know, we're also talking about, you know, this conceptualization of autonomy, right? How does CLR James look at autonomy in the context of a critique of coalition politics, right? Because again, this is also, you know, one of those particular areas of where anarchists kind of latch onto this critique of the state itself. Let's unpack that space right there. Let's just dive into that. How does CLR James?
CLR, when he was in the 1960s and 70s, the new generation, I don't know if they heard it from prejudices of other left parties, but there's this perception that CLR has anarchist affinities. CLR never claimed to be an anarchist. He read people who were anarchists. He was friends with people who were anarchists. Certainly his ideas have been an inspiration to some anarchists, but he always sees himself as an orthodox Marxist. But the problem is that most people are unfamiliar with the unorthodox and dissident currents of Marxism in the world. Certainly in the United States, that's been a problem. Of course, in the age of the internet, one can find anything now if you want to do the research, right? But back in his time, there were, but when I say his time, from the 30s to the 70s, there were left communists, anti-Bolshevik communists, council communists, left libertarians, people of with using, and then in the 70s, people called themselves autonomous Marxists. And then there were people who had been Marxists, like Murray Bookchin, who became an anarchist. And then there was people like Cornelius Castoriadis, who said, I'm discarding this project of Marxism, and I'm working on the project of autonomy. And so we mention all these names because when CLR breaks with the Leon Trotsky movement, all over the world, there are dissident currents who never joined the Trotsky movement. And also there are dissident currents breaking away from the Trotsky movement. And that raises a question in terms of how one sees the state, right? So obviously anarchists, not that all anarchists are the same, but anarchists in general are for the abolition of the state with no transitional period. Of course, Lenin wrote about all the problems of the state, but he said all power to the Soviets and repressed the independent self-governing Soviets. And we know because of the prestige of Bolshevism in the world, having seized state power, people think a Soviet is a Russian, but a Soviet is a workers', peasants', or soldiers' council, a self-governing political council independent of the state. So the question at hand in relation to, if you could just help clarify for me, James, the question that you were asking me about.
Right. So these conceptualizations, so, you know, the trends that are happening. So there is a particularity that CLR James is developing, this notion of autonomy.
Okay, so I know what I was going to say. So what I was going to say was my research, which I haven't published yet, but I might have made a passing reference, is that CLR James, while he read anarchist thinkers and was friends with anarchists, the left libertarian feeling of his ideas overwhelmingly come from nationalists and people who are perceived as conservative or even right-leaning philosophers of history in the 19th and early 20th century. So, for example, he read Spengler, Oswald Spengler. He read Jules Michelet, the historian of the French Revolution. Oswald Spengler wrote many books, but his famous one is Decline of the West, which is a whole lot more besides what people might think the Decline of the West might mean. and of course, he was influenced by G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, who were Edwardian radicals, that is in the late 19th, early 20th century. And they had a kind of populist attitude toward workers and a critique of the supposed progressive state. And so a lot of his rhetorical tools that he'll tell you, well, I got this from Marx, I got this from Hegel, I got this from Lenin. He read so widely that the vocabulary that he has, particularly of ideational sensations, I'm going to just throw out a few words to you, and then we can talk about what they might mean together. So he'll talk about the latent socialism among the working class, the half-buried ideas, their instincts, their elemental drives, all of this language, their essences. You can see some discussion of essences in Hegel and Marx, right? Certain parts of Hegel and Marx. This implies that ordinary people have a partial understanding of the social crises they face, and the cultivator of the popular will or the organizer's job is to help through associational life, right, to pool the multidirectional flows of thinking and learning and strategizing in the search for a type of wholeness or totality. Okay? So when you see him speculating dialectically about hierarchy and domination and the next development of political thought, or he's talking about the Greek city-state as a model, or he's referring to Rousseau's idea of the social contract, emphasizing with his interpretation of Rousseau that the social contract is between the people. It's not a contract with the government. Okay, these are things that are not strictly anarchist one way or another. There have been various thinkers who wrote with this kind of style of ideational sensations, right? Using ideas to imply that people have impulses and instincts that can be shaped up and pointed in a certain direction. But they're always leaping forward and failing to complete their search for freedom. You know, freedom struggles and their high tides, they appear, they disappear, and they reappear. So this kind of language makes CLR, among some people, perceived as a type of mystical, prophetic faith person, even though he was, you know, while familiar with religion, he was an atheist. But he's not a strident atheist. He's not he's actually, like Rousseau, he's a counter-enlightenment thinker, because he knows that reason has been abused. It's been abused by the advocates of the modern state and its planning of people's lives, right? And so this is where these perceived anarchist elements and mysticism in CLR come from. But what he's saying is, in the name of reason and consciousness raising, you have these people saying that everyone is deaf, dumb, and blind. He says they already have a partial understanding and instinct to govern themselves and solve the problems they face. Okay? So, but before I forget,
it's been a while.
That's it for Africa Woke Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa Woke Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa Woke Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Muntali, Africa Woke Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker Kurt Orderson, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa Woke Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa Woke Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
You're so strange, you don't say you don't leave. With the keys, open bow, open sky. On and on and on and on and on and to the place where the edge go round. This quiet is loud, clear and pronounced. Calling out your name, my answer to all, but don't stray. Strange, you don't leave, you don't stay. Back. You don't shine, you don't fade, but that's alright, that's it, that's alright. That's alright, that's it, that's alright, that's it, that's alright. Okay, alright, I said it's alright, it's alright. Okay, alright, I said it's alright, it's alright. Heartbeat like a drum in the breeze. You're so strange, you don't see it, don't need. Open road, open sky. On and on and on and on and on and on and to the place where the edge goes round. This part is loud, clear and pronounced. Calling out your name, my answer's over there that I know, but don't say. I guess you feel the same way. You're so strange. You don't leave, you don't stay. But that's okay. It's alright. It's okay. It's alright. It's alright. It's okay. It's alright. It's alright. You don't feel you don't burn. It's okay. It's alright. It's okay.
To please and forget. So